The WLEW News and Public Affairs Department now presents What Do You Think? Here is your host, Craig Routson, with today's topic.
Good morning. It is currently about 7 minutes past the hour of 10 o'clock. Our guest in the studio today from the Huron County Economic Development Corporation, its Executive Director, Carl Ossentoski, joining us again. Thanks for coming back, Carl.
Good morning. It's always fun to be here.
A lot of things going on through your office, and everybody with the hopefully got the recession behind us. We're looking at economic development as as a way to keep things moving forward, get that little steam engine, you know, I think I can going, and a lot of that falls into your court.
Well, we've seen a nice turnaround in the Thumb area. Agriculture has been a great support for the local economic community out there. So
that's kind of eating as a stable kind of thing.
we like to do that. So the agricultural community's been great. They've been investing in productivity. We've seen some nice expansions at some of the grain handling facilities, and a continued effort to expand some of those facilities at our local companies.
Did the downturn kind of help because people were really looking for work? Maybe they're getting better bids, this type of thing. Is there a reverse in that somehow?
I just think that a lot of the productivity gains from production ag is kind of rippling through. When you see corn increasing yields, you know, on a percentage basis that, you know, hasn't been seen in a long time, and then you have to do something with the corn once you harvest it. So then it goes into, you know, the local elevators. They have to expand capacity because they don't have enough. The challenge for us, and kind of where we've been focusing a lot of our attention on, is transportation of the commodities out of the area.
Keeping those rail lines here?
Well, keeping the rail lines here and improving the rail lines. Because you can put the trucks out there, but that tears up our roads.
And one train can carry, you know, 80 trucks.
Exactly.
It's just one. If you're going all to the same place, why have 80 trucks when you can have one train?
Exactly. The challenge is we want to see some track improvements. And one of the things that we've been hearing from our grain elevators is the ability to move unit trains, which are 90 car trains, so that they can load quickly, efficiently, and move their commodities out quickly and efficiently.
Are those longer than we have right now?
Yes. We don't have the capacity. And on the other side, on the rail side, we keep hearing that they don't have enough cars to be able to handle what we're able to produce up here. So we've been...
But we get it all at once. You know, a lot of, you know, crops come in and then you need all these cars. And then you, what do you do with them the other 9 months of the year? I mean, you store some grain and move it, but I mean, there's usually a big push right at harvest time. It moves it all around the country.
Right. But a lot of these folks, you know, I was chatting with some folks yesterday where the elevators will rotate their storage bins up to 3 times a year. So, you know, as the commodities come in, they need to process it and then move it back out. So what we've been looking at is, you know, how do we work with the railroad industry to add capacity up here in a reasonable way? We're not asking for, you know, high-speed rail.
You're talking 90-car trains. I think if you're at a crossing, you'd be hoping for a high-speed rail.
higher-speed rail rather than just slow rail. But that's what we want to do, is to make it economically feasible for the rail to make those kind of investments, and they feel comfortable enough to make those investments. What we've started to do is to survey some of the local grain elevators, manufacturers, folks that we think might be interested in shipping by rail, or if they already ship by rail, would they ship more by rail if they had more capacity?
And if you up the speeds, wouldn't that get into safety issues and such? Because people, A, are used to a certain speed, but you know, you see the train down the tracks, you know you can get across, but if it's going twice as fast, you might not judge it quite right.
Craig, I've seen you drive, so you...
But I mean, I've come up from and gone through, like, Emmett when the train goes through, and it's like, oh my gosh, you get whiplash, you try to read the cars, because it's moving.
But we're not talking about a huge increase. You know, if we can go from 15 miles an hour to 20 miles an hour, or 25 miles an hour, that would be a huge jump for us. So we're not talking about the kind of rail, the Class 1 rail systems, the Canadian National or the CSX rail. What we need is more capacity, and so that we can move the commodities faster. We've started to survey, as I said. We've had some discussions. We just became aware last week that Michigan Department of Transportation has started a 15-month effort to look at the rail kind of on a line from Muskegon over to Saginaw, all of the Thumb area, and then through northern Michigan up to the bridge, so that they can look at how that system is managed, who owns it. The state actually owns a pretty significant part of that rail system in the Cadillac area. So they have a vested interest in that. And the governor keeps on talking about increasing exports. Our ag community can increase exports easily if we can move the commodities to market that much more quickly.
And there's cross-border traffic at closest Port Huron
to get absolutely across. But in order to get to Port Huron, we have to take everything through Saginaw and back around. So it's this long kind, we're at the literally a dead end for the rail. It dead ends over in Croswell.
So we need the Thumb rail loop.
We do exactly. And that's part of the study that the state is doing, is to look at what kind of resources the state or the federal government can bring in along with the private sector to look at managing more effectively and working cooperatively on building that rail capacity.
Was this something that was decommissioned years ago and we wished we didn't? Because there used to be a pretty extensive, went up to Point Albarks. I mean, there was a lot of rails even in Huron County that had been abandoned, and we just have the network we have now. Was there a connection to Port Huron that just didn't quite make it?
Yes. Probably 15, 20 years ago, there was a whole series of short lines or sections of rail that were dropped. In Huron County, there was a rail line that went from Port Hope to Ruth through Harbor Beach, and all of that rail was abandoned and eventually went to the adjacent property owners. I know the city of Harbor Beach purchased some for their rails to trails, their bike trail through the community.
So you're going to tease them off if you say put the rails back.
Well, that might make some people upset, but we're not talking about putting new rail lines in. What we want to do is enhance the existing lines. And if there's ever the ability or the option of looking at extending rail, it makes a lot more sense to look at extending it from the south end of Sanilac County into Port Huron, because that would give us a loop. And I think we're talking 11, 12 miles. For the connector. But again, to build new rail, you have to secure right-of-way, and it gets incredibly expensive. So it's kind of, we have to look at the cost-benefit of completing something like that, or would it be better to invest in the rail that's already here and improve safety, speed, and the capacity of the existing rail, rather than add in a new rail line or spur.
All of these things are basically private companies that have to dream this up. All you can do is facilitate anything on the governmental level or maybe grants or something. But as far as, you're not going to go out there and hammer in the golden spike here.
I would like to. I would like to hammer it. But you're right. It gets complicated because if it's a road, M53, we've had some success adding some passing lanes on that.
You've got a whole M53 corridor group, don't you?
We do. And perhaps out of this, we've had some discussions with some of the local elevators. There used to be a group that got together to talk about rail. So that might be a kind of a natural evolution, is to reestablish that group to work with the rail lines. But it does get complicated because the rail lines are all private sector. Private companies.
Regulated by the government.
Regulated. See, that's where it gets complicated, because it's both regulated by the state and the federal government, especially the federal government. So it just, there's a lot of layers that we have to understand better than we have, because rail has been kind of ignored for a long time. But as gas prices, fuel prices start going up, it makes more sense to look at rail and the kind of capacity that you talked about.
So basically, you got to get all three of these groups on the same track.
Exactly. All of the commodity groups. The Michigan Agribusiness Association did a great study on agriculture and the growth of agriculture and the need for additional infrastructure, in particular rail. So we've been using that study to kind of get the state interested in doing some work on that, and we started to do our own survey so we can point to some of the local companies and say, you know, they would be willing to ship more if they had more capacity.
One thing that's been talked about around here, and I know it's not anywhere near the end of the line, but they talked about a deep water port in Harbor Beach. Would that be an access for grains, or would that be for other types of shipping?
It could. What we try to do is to understand how those commodities flow. Where do they go?
Just so you know, many people along the shoreline are saying deep water is an oxymoron. But
that's a different issue. That's a there are smarter people out there than me that understand that. But with the deep water port, the challenge is because there is no rail, so there's not a large capacity, and that particular dockage is set up to receive, not to ship out. Because and again, it's privately owned.
And it was to receive coal.
For the Detroit Edison Power Plant, which will soon be closing. But the challenge is to look at kind of that whole infrastructure in there. We've sat through some presentations where they talked about fast barges, where there would be these small containerized ships that could come in, pick up shipping containers full of grain, maybe specialty crops, maybe even manufactured products. And get it down to either Port Huron or probably the Port of Detroit, where they could be transloaded onto bigger ships and then, you know, ship globally.
Are these like the containers that are basically the box end of the truck, and they pick them up and they take the whole thing in one swoop?
Exactly. But we're not sure that we produce those type of commodities or products from our manufacturers that could be containerized and shipped that way. It might make more sense, and part of that is, you know, that's why we're starting to look at, you know, the entire transportation industry, is it might make more sense to ship that on rail, mm-hmm. and then transload it at a facility in Flint or Saginaw onto trucks or bigger trains or whatever it might be, so that they can be shipped and then transloaded again for final processing. So
all things seem to be coming around again. It seemed like the rail was out, and then all of a sudden, this is an efficient way of moving stuff again.
You know, if we could only look forward a little more clearly, we could make better decisions. But, you know,
that could have also been because we're the state with the automotive industry, and we were pushing for the trucks on the road and the cars for a long time, and when gas was cheap, you weren't thinking too much.
Right.
Of it.
And the industry, I mean, there's a lot of outsourcing, you know, the entire economy shifted around. And then, you know, with the latest recession, there's been more emphasis, you know, in our area on agricultural. Our manufacturers have done very well. We haven't seen, there was some downturn, but they've made a nice recovery. And so we're starting to look at, you know, how we can move that stuff effectively. Also, gas prices were really cheap, so it made more sense to ship by truck at a certain point. But now, with escalating gas prices, with other requirements,
just the cost of all the people involved. Once you get it on the train, it's the engineer and the guy in the back with the lantern saying ding, 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 and away you go, so to speak.
Yeah, but exactly. I mean, it's much more efficient to do it. The challenge to work with manufacturing and rail are things like a lot of the automotive industries are set up for just-in-time. So there's a window, usually several hours, for delivery so that they can put it into the production lines. Rail doesn't have that capacity yet. They can't ship that quickly. So, you know, that's why we're leaning towards bulk commodities, our corn, soybeans, those type of things, so that that doesn't have that tight of delivery windows.
It would also be good to just have some extra capacity around when they have the big droughts out west or whatever. We could ship hay. I mean, if we have a good crop here, it's the hard part is getting it to where it's needed.
Exactly.
Know?
And again, those are things that are shifting around. I mean, they're predicting continuing droughts in the Midwest. Michigan had some dry weather, but we had a nice recovery last year. So
we had more rain in January than we had in June of last year. I don't understand that, but okay.
Yeah. It's always fun in Michigan.
Isn't it?
But those are all the factors that we kind of, and the challenge from our part is it's always changing. You know, 20 years ago, we were looking at surface. That's why we were pushing M53. Now we're back looking at how do we more effectively move the commodities using rail, deep water port, you know, and all of those things are kind of in play. So it's an ongoing challenge for us to kind of keep all those balls in the air.
And do you have to look at the local infrastructure? I know you've upgraded some roads to Class A just mm-hmm. so that, you know, they can handle the heavier loads all right. the time. If you're going to do more containerized shipping around the area, you're going to have roads that can handle extra
sure.
load.
Yep. And we continually look at that. We have regular discussions with the Road Commission to look at how we can provide any kind of assistance we can to look at where those roads are. If there are grants or other funding sources, we try to participate as much as we can.
Many times, though, it kind of boils down a little bit that you want to make sure that those benefit from it are participating in it.
Absolutely.
That's not a gimme. Right. That's kind of changed as years and years ago.
Right.
When I'm the government, I'll do it for you. Now we need to see that you really want this.
And there's been a lot more emphasis on public-private partnerships. That's the buzzword, is private PPP. And we see that more and more. I mean, if there's needed infrastructure capacity for a particular facility, we meet with the company to talk about, you know, what their needs are. If they can contribute something, then we go to the state and to the federal government to see what we can access as far as grants or loans or those type of things.
That's the kind of thing that helped Huron Castings get the power line they needed to do
absolutely,
all of that stuff.
Absolutely.
That they do so, there now.
Right. So, you know, we try to fill the gaps when we can. We look at how we can assist the communities and the businesses as well. So it's an ongoing puzzle for us.
And how do you ride the rails on this, Carl? Do the businesses need to come to you to say, you know, we could really use this improvement? Is there any way you can facilitate help for us to get it? Do you have to see it and then go to the business and say, this would work, maybe you should do it? I mean,
all of that. The easiest part for us is to have the business as early in their planning process as possible. You know, if they're thinking about adding capacity, if they came to us and said, you know, we really would like to look at, you know, doing an improvement on the road, or we could use a new rail spur here. What we would do is then we could get with the, you know, correct departments, whether it's the Road Commission, Michigan Department of Transportation, and sit down and look at what their particular issues are, what kind of capacity, investment, jobs, those kinds of factors. Then we would go back and try to craft a solution, whether that would be, you know, private participation, public participation, or more than likely all three. I mean, it would be everybody kind of pooling their resources and seeing what might be available and how we could affect good change.
Now, we've been out in the thumb, and, you know, a lot of people think in the rural area you're out of touch, but we are getting some of the highest tech fiber optics coming into the area,
that's
one of the major things that companies look for today, is because they do a lot of business between different parts of their organization, and they need fast access to. They can download models, they can do any kind of thing they want. Hospitals use it for x-rays and all diagnostic type of things. You even have a doctor in another county on the fiber optics
yep.
helping to diagnose you. It's all coming to Huron County.
And we're excited because, just as you said, out in rural areas, you expect minimal services at best.
You expect a guy with a telegraph key, ones and zeroing your internet.
That's what our friends in urban areas like to think and portray us. But we've got a couple projects. Pigeon Telephone, AVCI, has a huge project going on throughout the Thumb area, installing fiber to their cell towers, and they'll have capacities, from what we've been told, on that fiber network. And the other one,
I believe the county building's being
exactly
to it,
exactly
911 dispatch.
And that's a way to become more efficient. Instead of multiple T1 lines, which are very expensive, this could be one fiber optic connection can serve all of the needs plus. So there's lots of capacity. Air Advantage out of Frankenmuth is installing a 300-mile fiber network as well. So.
It's kind of augmenting what they had
had initially, and what it does is kind of build out some of the infrastructure from past projects.
Which went to just like major towns, but now you can go out to some of the smaller towns
and the
points in between, because there's going to be connections available
there. Right. And so what that gives us the capability of is recruiting high-tech businesses. We had some folks over in Harbor Beach that we were chatting with, and they said, you know, setting in Harbor Beach, we would never have believed, and these are folks that are came in from outside of the area and work in the technology sector, and came to us and said, you know, it was strange because within a week we had two companies knocking on our door offering us fiber service. And they said, we've worked in other communities around the country and we've never had that happen, and let alone in a rural community. So what we're just starting to do is to look at how we can craft a marketing campaign to market that fiber capacity. What you know we have is special, but the rest of the country is going to catch up. We don't think as quick as we're getting it installed up here, but to have two companies installing that type of capacity is unique. So,
and for a real major company, they could use both. One as a backup or such. So they're never out. If it's like a call center or a server thing for computers and other places.
Exactly. We've looked at locations for server farms, which are the cloud-based computing, Amazon, any of the big technology companies run their own server farms, Yahoo, Microsoft. And so what we've started to do is to look at things like energy provision, because they need backup power. You can't lose power. You need redundant data feeds. We've got two fiber optic networks. So we're starting to look at how we can look at that industry or those types of industries.
And a lot of these places are looking for renewable energy in the area.
They are. And, you know, we've seen Google buy literally...
They bought wind farms.
Pay for wind farms down in Texas. And so we're starting to look at, you know, they could be purchasing the capacity, power purchase agreements from the existing wind farms, or even installing new wind farms, solar, all of the renewable energies that we're hosting up here could be another selling point. So they can reduce their carbon footprint, because server farms are huge users of energy, both for cooling, usually for cooling.
But we now have the thumb loop to help with the power.
We do. So all of the pieces are kind of fitting together rather nicely. So we're excited to look at, once those projects are completed, before they're completed, what we're trying to do is to put together some of the marketing pieces so we can start selling Huron County as a place to do business.
Now, you don't just work in Huron County, though. You kind of help go around into some of the other counties, too, don't you, Carl? You got many hats, and basically...
some of them are black, some of them are white.
Well, when you're the good guy, and the bad guy, they tell them you can't do it.
Yep.
But I mean, you work cooperatively throughout the area. It's not always just Huron County.
Absolutely. About a year and a half ago, we established a contract with the Sanilac Board of Commissioners. They had some changes in their economic development. And so we sat down with them and said, you know, is there anything that we can do to provide services? My board of directors thought that it was an efficient way to use our expertise, our office. So what we do is we provide services, economic development services, on a part-time basis down in Sanilac County.
And this is what the governor has been trying to push in government quite a bit, is combining and sharing of resources and such.
Absolutely. So we've got the contract. We do work up in Huron County, obviously, but then we've started to do work in Sanilac County. We have a great working relationship with the folks over in Tuscola County at their EDC. In fact, we're going to be participating in a couple workshops that they're developing right now. We'll help market them for our businesses up here. But on a larger scale, we're part of the governor's effort to consolidate and regionalize economic development. We're a partner in the Great Lakes Bay region. Economic development.
I know.
That's the name.
That's a whole show in itself.
Yes. write that down. You could use that. But the idea is that we can consolidate resources. So ours is one of the larger areas, where it's the entire Thumb area, Saginaw Bay, Midland, goes over as far north as Clare, or down into Gratiot County. So kind of that mid-state area wrapped around the bay, Aranac County. And what we've been able to do is we meet on a monthly basis to talk about regional issues. One of the exciting things that we've been able to do is working cooperatively with the folks from Saginaw County is they've been using a new site marketing piece, where if we've got an industrial site, a building, just available property, We kept that in a three-ring binder in our office because we knew where it was. With the new system, what we can do is we can upload the information to a centralized database with GIS mapping attached to it, with videos, with photographs, list the local realtors or the local contacts. And what it does is it provides a much broader market. Attached to that whole database are things like demographics. It's who the local utility providers are. All of that can be generated with a couple clicks of a button on all of the buildings over 50,000 square feet in the entire 13 county area, literally in a half an hour, where before we would have to do it over a course of a week, and we would be driving out to take pictures and, you know, and updating our list from our three-ring binder. All of that's online now. And we couldn't have been able, we wouldn't have been able to do that but for our participation in that Saginaw Bay region. So we're excited about that because it gives us a much broader ability to market the sites and locations. And again, talking about, you know, we can attach sites that have rail, that have access to the new fiber networks, to the water systems that we have up here. So it's an exciting process. And, you know, again, it wouldn't have been done, you know, 5 years ago. But because of the governor's work on regionalization, we've been trying to live up to his standards.
Is it all kind of just with the notion that no county is an island? You can do all the developing you want up here, but if you hit the county line and the infrastructure isn't there for the trucks to get here, for the power, all that other stuff, it doesn't do you any good.
Right. Oh, exactly. I mean, people don't look at, you know, it's like when we do our tourism marketing, they don't come up to Huron County, they come up to Caseville, Port Austin, Harbor Beach, whatever it might be. They want, they're going to be looking at areas of the state. They're going to be looking at transportation issues. You know, a lot of times we've been seeing some requests for buildings that specifically say it has to be 10 minutes, 15 minutes from the nearest interstate. Well, that automatically rules us out. But there are other ones that might say, we just saw one a couple weeks ago, that would have been perfect for a server farm, you know, with power and the fiber optic networks, all of those pieces, we were able to, you know, put a, together a response. We weren't successful. They were looking at more of the Detroit metro region. But we're able to do that much more effectively on a regional basis than trying to do it, you know, on a countywide basis.
Because no county's an island.
It's just not.
We may be on the tip of a peninsula, but we're still connected.
We are. And, you know, and that's the state's perspective as well, is that they're trying to sell the resources, the abilities, the talent in the state. So it's not just, you know, in the Lansing area or Detroit area. The state's successful if they locate somewhere in the state. We'll be successful if they locate somewhere in the, you know, upper thumb area. Because, you know, to be honest, people will drive, you know. I live in Ubley, drive to Bad Axe. So it's the labor markets are much more porous up here. So, you know, it's not just, business doesn't stop at the county line. It goes through. So
years ago, I remember people driving from Minden all the way down to the GM Tech Center in Warren.
Absolutely.
I mean, people just want to live in a quiet rural area.
Quiet rural area. So that's what we're going to be talking about, but with some nice technology add-ons.
Got to give them what they want.
Exactly.
They aren't going to come because they aren't going to build it.
Right.
They want it here when they
want to be able to plug it in. So, and that's the challenge, is to keep up with the latest technology changes, to market that. And, you know, even the marketing is changing. What we're doing right now is we're evaluating some opportunities using social media to have Facebook and Twitter and Pinterest and everything, Google Plus. And just saw a new add-on for Twitter where it's 6-second videos. So, and what that does is that holds our marketing costs down. We don't have to pay for print. We don't have to pay, and it can be done in real time. So the challenge for us is we're a relatively small office. We have to think about how we can implement that type of system and still do the kinds of work on railroads.
Well, and you do a lot of other things in the office.
We do.
Communities come to you looking for grants. Mm-hmm. If they're looking to expand a park or something else, they come to you and say, is there anything out there? And you end up doing the research and seeing what's out there. And lots of times, I think you help them through the application process as well.
We do. We'll do the research. we'll write the grants with them. And sometimes, depending on the community, we'll actually work through the process of the implementation of the grant. Because a lot of times, there's a huge reporting burden that's put on the local communities. We've got, with some of the grants, we've gotten very good at it. And so we can move the process along pretty smoothly. We know the reporting requirements, so we can set up the system so that we can report and make it easier for the businesses and or communities that are involved.
Grants are always competitive, it seems, but has it gotten worse because of the economy? There's less out there and more people vying for it because they're looking to augment any way they can.
Absolutely. And with the drop in the tax bases in the local communities because of the drop in property values, before what they might have self-financed, now they're looking for additional resources. It's gotten very competitive. And what's happened is that before, what would happen is that the local match, what the local community would put into the project might have been 20%. And the rules are still the same. It's still 20%. But in order to be competitive, it's more like 40%. Otherwise, you go to the bottom of the list and you're never called. So the challenge is that it's gotten more competitive. We have to put in, local communities have to put in more money. And that's probably good because there's more buy-in. They're committed to the projects then. So we try to encourage communities to be strategic. You know, if it's a big project that qualifies, then they should be going after grants. If it's smaller opportunities that they might be able to self-finance, we said, you know, don't wait for the state. Just, you know, keep making those local investments.
And sometimes those local investments are more cost-effective because once you start getting grant money, the strings start coming out, and you get the wage requirements and all the other things that go into things that you might find your local person down the street who lives in town is willing to do it for less than what the state would mandate you'd have to do with a grant.
Absolutely. We've heard stories of, you know, buying bicycle racks for $3,000 and, you know, a custom-designed one fabricated locally costs a fraction of that. So that's what, and it's good for our local businesses. So that's where we encourage folks is to, if we can do it locally, let's do it locally. And with all the strings and the reporting requirements are getting more and more stringent, the federal government, state government wants to make sure that you're accountable, and we should be. But what
and
it does
times
is
they're looking to see what kind of bang they're getting for their bucks on these kind of projects, and that kind of stipulates whether they're going to go that way in other projects in the future because they did it create jobs, did it bring more into the community, or more shops opening up in town that were closed. All these types of things play into it that if you just do it yourself, sometimes you miss out on all that fun.
Exactly. So, you know, we and that's part of what we try to provide back to the local communities is we try to work with them and say, is there a balance? You know, is this a good grant project for the community and for, you know, or should we look at self-funding because it's quicker, easier, and you can usually, it's much more cost-effective.
Usually the big ones like utilities and such, those normally need some type of extra help. Like
absolutely.
Usually USDA or rural development comes in and at least helps, but again, funds are not infinite anymore, and you're competing with everybody else.
You know, if you're putting in a big playscape, that makes it probably appropriate for a grant. But if you're doing, you know, bicycle racks, or, you know, you're restriping bike lanes, or
park benches,
you know, those are the kinds of things that can be done locally. Service groups might be interested in doing those kinds of things. So that's where we try to look at, you know, what's the balance. If we can add park benches into a bigger project, we try to do that. So, you know, every project is looked at individually. We try to maximize the impact for the local community and keeping in mind that there's accountability standards that we try to live up to so that we have a successful project so that when we go back to the state, we can say, we had a successful project last time. We think this is going to be even better this time. It's part of the sales process.
You don't succeed, you end up at the bottom of the list
again. Exactly. And that's not what we want to do. So we want to make sure that when we pitch a project to the state or to the federal government, that it's a quality project, that we know that it's going to be successful, and that we can move it.
And that the local funds are there to go through with it if it is approved, because nothing is worse to the state than you having it go through the whole approval process and then turning down the money.
We've done that several times, and it doesn't look good. So, yes, we try to make sure that the community's on board with the project. It's a science and an art. So we try to make sure that we represent the communities well, that we make sure that we represent the state well, and you know, we're doing quality projects in the communities.
And you not only work for governments and municipalities and such, you try to help people as they're getting started too. You've had incubators in the mm-hmm. past that are mm-hmm. For food and such. Are they still going? Are
yep.
you working on those?
We've been the FoodWorks incubator over at the Tech Center in Bad Axe. We've got, I think, 4 clients in there right now. So, and again, we try to market that as much as we can. The challenge for us is that there's always a balance in all of these projects. With our incubator at the Tech Center, it's truly a teaching kitchen. And so we have to carve out the time that the students are in that kitchen for students. And that's the first priority. Absolutely, and it's always been right from the start. So what we do is we work around the students' time. That limits the number of folks that use the kitchen. And the challenge for us with the kitchen incubator is our location. We're in a peninsula, inside of a peninsula. So we get folks that will call about using it from the Bay City, Saginaw, Flint areas. We've had folks from Oakland County come up and look at it. The challenge for them is that it's a hour, 2 hour drive to come up and process, and they may have to do that 3 times a week.
In the middle of the night.
In the middle of the night. Because four entrepreneurs in the kitchen doesn't sound like a lot, but it actually is for the area. And we keep entertaining tours, and we encourage people. We've had some folks from Sanilac County starting to look at it again. So, but again, part of the issue is distance.
And it's designed, hopefully, that as they grow and expand, then they will see a point where they need their own facilities.
Exactly.
And then they're truly on their own. You have an opening and another person.
And in fact, we graduated one. Our success story is MJ's Cupcakery.
Ah.
She was a student at the...
And you didn't bring samples?
She makes me pay for the samples.
Oh, she's
a good business person. She's a great business person. But what she was able to do was she started off at the Tech Center as part of the program, came into the incubator, kind of tested the market, tested the recipes, getting out into the market. I know she's at the Port Austin Farmers Market. She sells into some of the local stores. And it reached the point where she felt comfortable enough where she set up her own kitchen. And we graduated her. So, and she's still out doing business. So,
And this teaches them what they need in a commercial kitchen, because it differs from your household kitchen.
It does.
And you have to learn to make huge batches that come out as good as the small batches you make. And all these things take a little time to get your rhythm going.
Scaling is important. Packaging is important. I may make the best cookies in the world, but I have to label them, package them. What is the shelf life? You know, around our house, the cookies might not last a long time. But, you know, if it's sitting on a store shelf, it has to be shelf stable. You have to go through all the testing. The state has to give you a permit. We require that you have food handling training. So there's a lot of steps that we go through in order to help those folks be successful.
And when you get a success story, it's always good, and it opens up room for the next person.
Absolutely.
How do you decide who goes in next? Do they have to present a business plan to your board? Do they come in and kind of give you an idea? They give you cupcakes to test and say,
well,
I think these are going to fly.
Samples are always good. We have the luxury of not having a waiting list. What we can do, the way the process works is that they fill out an application, so we know what kind of product that they're going to be producing in the kitchen. Then we have them go through, or if they haven't already had it, food safety training called ServSafe, which is put on by MSU Extension, has classes. Some folks have done self-study where we can get them a book, they can study the book and then take the test. We require insurance, and the final step in the process is to have the state come in and watch you go through the process in the kitchen, so they know how you're going to handle the food, is it safe, and then they issue you a permit. Once we go through all of those steps and we have all of it documented, then the Tech Center issues a key card, and you have 24-hour, 7-day-a-week access. Working around
the students.
But on Saturdays, Sundays, during the summer, we have our entrepreneurs in there all the time.
Cupcakes are year-round. Something like a jam or something might be more seasonal.
It's more seasonal. Exactly. And we've got a company that comes in on a seasonal basis. They have sweet corn. So what they do is they process the sweet corn, freeze it, and then it's sold into some of the local food stores in the area. So, and again, that's done in a very short window in the summer when the corn's coming in. So, you're right. It's sometimes it's year round. Other times it's it's for 4 weeks during August, September.
And a year round would be more conducive to getting your own kitchen set up than if you're going to be doing it for six
Absolutely.
Weeks out of the year.
Absolutely. So, and again, it's a great resource. We tell that to the tech center and to the intermediate school district all the time. We're very appreciative of their support for the incubator because we're using their facility.
It's a community facility. I think they feel that way, and I think it's helping people in the community. And why just let it sit there idle?
Exactly. And I think that's the approach that they, when we first started talking about it, that's exactly the approach that they had. Was it's sitting there, it's not in use. How can we use it more effectively? And we were able to put together a great partnership with them.
And the only thing I'm sure they're concerned about is that it's as clean as when you came, when you leave.
And our folks in there oftentimes leave it as clean, sometimes cleaner. We like to emphasize that it should be cleaner.
Well, yeah, but you have to be a good steward if you're going to have them invite you back again and again.
Exactly. So we want to make sure that they're aware of the standards of the tech center, and we abide by those standards. Absolutely.
We're getting a little towards the end of the time. Are there things you wanted to make sure we touched on?
Just wanted to let people know we've had a project that we just completed. In Huron County, we received some grant funds, about $400,000, for a brownfield assessment program, which we would go out, we received grant funds from the EPA to go out and look at sites that may be contaminated and do testing of those sites to find out what the contaminants are, how we might be able to manage that space, whether it could be built on, whether they could, and what kind of cleanup, if there was cleanup needed, what that needed to be.
Which helps with somebody trying to buy it knowing where they stand.
Exactly. And it helps the community understand what what's on that site. There are incentives that we can put on the table if business is interested in reusing that site, because typically in brownfields the infrastructure, sewer, water, roads are already there. We're just reusing an existing site. So as I said, that project kind of wound up.
Are you looking for people who kind of have a deal in mind at this point? Because there's a lot of them out there, and I think you would want to prioritize someone who's, they're interested, but we need to know what's under the ground here before we can finalize anything and they know what they're doing. I think that would probably be a little more priority.
Yes. We just don't go out and test sites because we think it's, or know it's contaminated. And again, we finished our project. We don't have any more funds. However, when we talked about our regional approach, we've put together a regional grant application for the EPA. We're hoping to hear probably in May or June of this year. Three counties, here in Tuscola and Sanilac, and it's actually for an assessment grant of, I think we applied for about $500,000, where we could use that $500,000 to go out where we have a potential project, and XYZ companies interested in buying that, what used to be a corner gas station, they want to put up a McDonald's. We can go in and do the testing, find out what's there, and it saves them some time and money at the front end of the project, and hopefully will entice more projects on those existing sites. Then we applied for, I believe, $600,000 for a regional revolving loan fund. So we could go in and do the testing initially. Company says, yeah, but I'm not sure about it. We can help finance some of the cleanup cost with the revolving loan fund at extremely low interest rates.
But they pay it back.
They pay it back.
You've got that in the fund to redo it the
exactly.
second time around.
Exactly. And the third time and the fourth time and the fifth time. So it's set up so that we can help incent some of those projects, provide some local incentives to get some of those contaminated sites cleaned up and reused. So we're excited about that. We're keeping our fingers crossed. We were close last time. We tried it last year, and we were really close, but missed by a few points. So we've redid it and kind of reduced it. Last year we were asking for $1 million each. We thought that might have been overreaching a little bit. So we kind of backed it off and said, we'll come in a little lower. So hopefully we'll get more points for being more modest. But we're excited. And we think it's a great benefit for the community. These sites need to be reused or cleaned up, and it provides some incentives to get those things cleaned up and reused.
One of the things EDC has been involved in is the Trek organization. And
yes.
You've been working, if I remember correctly, and I'm trying to get the synapses to fire in the right order, but I believe you were working on some sort of study on the depreciation schedules, going to see if you can work something out with DTE, with the State Tax Commission, to see if something can be done, come up to some sort of agreement, because people are on opposite sides of the fence here.
Not opposite sides. What we're working on is an understanding of what the true cash value of those wind turbines might be. The State Tax Commission changed some of the depreciation schedules. And
not only how much is depreciated, but how long.
How long,
it's all
right,
depreciated
right.
out, which all adds up to money to local governments.
To local governments, and that's what we want. You know, we're hosting the wind farms, and we feel strongly that those wind farms should be contributing to the local community. So what we've been doing is working on with a not just in a regional basis, because it started off as the Thumb Regional Renewable Energy Collaborative. It is now the Michigan Renewable Energy Collaborative. We have five counties that we're partnering with, Huron, Tuscola, Sanilac, Gratiot, and Mason County. There's a few more that are getting some projects that we might be able to bring in. And what we're trying to do is to work collaboratively on the issue of taxes and how that's approached. We're still, the latest test for us was the elimination of industrial personal property, which was successful and signed by the governor last year. But we were successful in carving out and preserving as a separate piece of the legislation, taxes on the wind turbines, which was a huge benefit because they were at risk of being lost totally.
Which is sometimes difficult when you only got five counties who are really pushing for this out of 83 in the state.
Right.
And none of you are the big ones, you know, with a big population base and such. You're small rural communities that can host wind turbines.
Exactly. So our voice oftentimes gets lost. So our work has been to make sure that our voice isn't lost. So what we've been doing is there's been some discussions about how we could approach the State Tax Commission, Department of Treasury, because that's who's hosts the State Tax Commission, and have them look at reevaluating those depreciation schedules. So we're in the process of doing that. It's a long, drawn-out process. I have a short attention span, so I want to get things done quickly, and it keeps being pointed out that this is a long 24-month at least process of going through some of this stuff. So
Sometimes they're quick, sometimes you have to work for things.
Well, exactly. And you know, but it's one of those things that I think is important to the local communities, to the counties involved, and to the Thumb area. I mean, there's a huge investment. You know, when you start looking at the kind of investment that's going in, it's unprecedented in the Thumb area. Just the power line, the ITC power line that's going through, is $500 million. So you start, and then you start factoring in some of the wind turbines, and you know, it's multiple billions of dollars. And there's, you know, there's 70 on slate, at least 70 for 2013. We've met with some folks down in Sanilac County where they're looking at 2014 and 2015 once the ITC thumb loop is completed at the south end. So there's going to be additional investments going on, and what we want to do is to make sure that the community's benefit and the local residents benefit. How can we bring those benefits back to the local community? So but it's a long process, and we're dedicated to toughing it out and seeing what we can do.
I appreciate you taking time with us today, Carl.
It's always a pleasure.
If they have questions or they want to get a hold of the office, how do they do that?
They can email me at yes, 20th Century.
I thought you were going to give them your Pinterest address.
No. I can only do email. So far, I do it in small bites. It's carl@huroncounty.com. They made it simple for me, so I can't mess it up. And they can Of course, stop by the office. We're always, somebody's usually in the office.
We're at the third
floor of the county building, room 303.
You walk out the elevator and you go right into your room.
Yep. And they can call us at 989-269-6431.
6431.
Perfect.
And Monday through Friday.
Yep.
And if they have needs as far as maybe grants, as far as any economic development things they see going on, you might be a good resource to start with.
Absolutely. We may not have all the answers. And I want to emphasize that the earlier in the process that they can bring us in, that they feel comfortable, the better it is, because there might be some additional resources. The state is always bringing on new programs and getting rid of old programs, so there's always changes, and we encourage people, both businesses and communities, as they work through individual projects, if they can bring us in as early as possible, and if we've got some resources that we can bring in, you know, even better, because a lot of times grants can't, even if we apply for grants, go through the process, they literally cannot start the project. They can't put a shovel in the ground to sign a contract until we get all of the state approvals, which can take 3 months. So,
and they need to know how to keep their ducks in line if they want to actually get the golden goose at the end there.
Exactly. So that's why we encourage them, is if there's an inkling of a project out there, that they talk to us, and you know, if we're able to, if we think that there's an opportunity, then we can set the process up so that timing-wise it doesn't slow the project down, but and we can successfully get some grant funding for them.
Again, that telephone number?
989-269-6431.
And I do want to thank you for being with us today, Carl.
It's
always fun. We could talk for another hour on other things.
I have an entire list.
We'll have to do that on another day sometime.
Okay.
But I appreciate you taking the
Anytime.
Time to come out here and let people know what's going on in the office, and that economic development didn't come to a standstill with the recession. Everybody kept pushing, trying to keep it going.
Yep, absolutely.
Our guest today on the program has been Carl Osentoski, Executive Director of the Huron County Economic Development Corporation in the County Courthouse Building in Bad Axe. I do want you to stay tuned. Coming up at the top of the hour, we will clue you in on all the latest in the news.